If you ask me what's my number one frustration right now, it's that people keep saying and believing that we live in an information age when, you know, you could not have come up with a more narcissistic term, because we don't know really anything at all.
I'm your host, Adam Mett, and today we're chatting with Lucas Joppa, the Chief Environmental Officer of Microsoft. We talk about Bill Gates, artificial intelligence, and an interesting solution to air travel. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here is Lucas Joppa on Planet Reimagined. So to start off, very easy, if you could pick one environmental problem to solve, and if you knew that over the next 10 to 20 years that you could solve it, what would you choose and why?
Well, I think on behalf of humanity, I'd have to choose climate stabilization. That's super short and simple. You want my personal answer?
I want your personal answer.
Deeply committed to biodiversity conservation and slowing the extinction of species. That's my passion. That's what got me into all of this. What gets me out of bed in the morning is not the beauty of, you know, the first law of thermodynamics. It's the beauty of evolution. But I think what the world needs is to take heed of the first law of thermodynamics. It's the first order environmental problem that we have to solve, full stop.
So speaking of the first law of thermodynamics, you come from an academic background. What was that like, taking that deep academic research and translating it into the private sector?
Well, it was weird, but not as weird as you might think. I had the benefit of a fairly soft landing. I came from academia and landed in, you know, one of the world's largest companies, but I landed in this kind of interesting spot. When I joined Microsoft, it was in an organization called Microsoft Research. So really the blue sky research arm of the company, you know, I would sometimes describe it as the University of Microsoft. So I really got to lead a very academic life inside a corporate ecosystem that allowed me to understand how it worked and all of that stuff. It took me, I mean, nobody's ever figured it out, right? But it's taken me 7 years probably to figure out the right way to take pure research, science, and really connect it up all the way up to higher corporate purpose and programs. I mean, that's what I do now, but there's no way I could have come straight into Microsoft and done that. It would have been a disaster.
Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot. And, you know, with the work that I do, I try and draw those connections between things. But you mentioned Microsoft, so let's just jump right in. You know, when you think Microsoft, a lot of people will think Bill Gates. And, you know, there are a few times in history where one person becomes so fundamentally associated with an idea and a product. However, now Bill Gates has become synonymous with solving giant global issues, especially through the foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. How did global sustainability, and in particular, environmentalism, become such a core part of what Microsoft is?
Well, you know, a lot of this, well, everything started with Bill. Bill, Paul, and the rest of the crew that really kicked off Microsoft. When I joined, of course, it was Steve Ballmer, and now it's Satya Nadella. But the path that was paved for me to join and all of this work was actually with Bill and his vision and permission to set up a research group in what was called computational ecology, led by an incredible individual named Stephen Emmett, somebody that more people should know about. Wrote a really great book called 10 Billion, actually, while he was my boss. But Bill had that foresight to say, we need to be thinking 30, 50 years into the future, and we need to be investing out there. So, you know, we started taking these steps. We were preparing ourselves for what we knew was going to come, which was a global reckoning with climate. And so we were doing that hard work, preparing ourselves inside the company and starting to connect up the research with what our company is, which is a technology company and a cloud and AI company. So the way that this all kind of left peer research was actually, again, through a soft landing. I left Microsoft Research as the first chief environmental scientist for the company to go start a new program called AI for Earth. So that was really the first program directly deploying machine learning technologies and artificial intelligence technologies more broadly in the four key areas of climate, water, ag, and biodiversity. It was a five-year, $50 million commitment. And it was the company's kind of first bite of the apple, really, and how are we going to start to integrate this outside of research but into the whole company? And then from that, that became, you know, the template for all of our AI for Good programs, a much broader suite that then, you know, kicked off a lot of action in this space across the tech sector. And I continue to oversee that program, but then took on environmental sustainability as the first chief environmental officer for the company and just kept that march forward, right, of saying, this is an issue that is about our people, it's about our technology, it's about our customers, and it's about society, and therefore it's about our future ability to succeed. And we've finally now wrapped it together. You know, the last 12 months, which we can talk about, has been all about setting what I, you know, what people have called ambitious sustainability commitments, what I would call just the commitments that you need to make to build a more sustainable future. And now, you know, the hard work for kind of the corporates of the world and the folks like me in them that have to get this stuff done, it's the details. It's making sure that these aren't just things that we aspire to, but things that we actually do.
This is a point that's of great interest to me, tying the pledges that a company is making for their internal practices to the work that they're using to help inspire other companies and the products they're putting out there to help individuals become more aware and take action. And that's something that Microsoft is doing an incredible job at, not to make this sound like an advertisement for saying what a great job Microsoft is doing. But I want to talk about a bunch of these different pledges that you mentioned that you made over the last year and a bunch of these campaigns, because they're interesting, they're boundary pushing, and they seem unattainable at first look. So I want to dive into them. So you've taken a pledge to be carbon negative by 2030, and that's, you know, in line with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. How do you plan to do that? And what about the carbon that Microsoft has put into the atmosphere over the last many decades of production?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big goal. Carbon negative is Microsoft's goal, carbon negative by 2030. Again, though, you talked about how you tie it to, you know, action, how you tie it to employees and broader societal action. Well, upstream, right? If I think about this as a supply chain and a value chain problem, well, what's my supply chain? My supply chain for these commitments is the best available international science. And so when, you know, I said people say these are ambitious goals, well, look, they're just the goals. They're just what we're going to have to do. If you go and look at the IPCC's reports over the years, the one that really woke people up, I think, I don't know why, because there wasn't anything that net new in it, but for some reason it just kind of landed at the right time in the right place, was their special report on climate change of 1.5 degrees Celsius. And basically, for some reason, the world freaked out, and appropriately so. I mean, they were saying something they've been saying for a long time, which is we have to drastically reduce our carbon emissions. Full stop. And we've got to get to a net zero carbon economy by 2050. And one thing that I thought was so transformative about that report is for the first time, I would say at the first kind of consensus level, there was an acknowledgement that a net zero carbon economy is going to require significant removal, of course, but there's no credible economic model that doesn't show our global society overshooting our carbon budget and thus needing to actually remove carbon. So that is a super long prelude to answering your question, which is, yes, we committed to being a carbon negative company. You know, the next level down is we're going to achieve that by reducing our emissions by half or more and removing the rest. Removing the rest, including our historical emissions since we were founded in 1975. That last bit comes between 2030 and 2050. And there's a lot of details underneath it. How do you reduce your emissions, right? Well, we're a cloud and AI company. What powers the cloud and all of the AI that runs on it? Electricity, Right. So looking at, you know, the way the carbon accountants kind of break this space down is what they would call scope one, scope two, and scope three carbon. Scope one is what you directly emit. You know, we have, for instance, diesel generators at our data centers right now. Scope two is the emissions associated with the energy that you consume. Scope three is quite literally everything else, right? Your supply chain, your value chain, everything else. So when we set these goals, we said we're going to set these goals across scope one, scope two, and scope three. So we were going to be very inclusive with our portfolio, and we were going to have meaningful actions that we could take in all of those areas. So scope one, we're doing things like 100% electrification of our campus vehicle fleets, replacing by 2030 all the diesel fuel that we're using to create backup power for all of our data centers, right? Very practical, tactical things. Scope two, we're going to move to 100% renewable energy by 2025 for our entire global business through direct power purchase agreements. Scope three, we're going to go and work with our suppliers, customers, et cetera. We already have made a bunch of progress in that, modifying our supplier code of conduct, which is the contract that sits under every single thing that we do. But it's a little bit harder than just saying you're going to go and do these things. You really have to kind of juice the system a little bit because the world isn't ready. And so we announced kind of two financial mechanisms that we were going to put in play. The first is what I call the fee. So we have an internal carbon fee that applies across all of our scope one, two, and three emissions. And that really, you know, basically taxes everybody across the company to raise revenue to be able to go in and purchase all the carbon removal that we need to do. It also incentivizes the removal, right? Because you can avoid that fee. The second mechanism is what is the fund, the Climate Innovation Fund, a new $1 billion investment fund that we announced that's investing in primarily, you know, carbon, but broadly climate stabilization technologies and projects around the world.
That's incredible. We've spoken about carbon so far, and obviously we know there are other greenhouse gases that are problems, methane, hydrofluorocarbons, things like that. Is Microsoft working on anything to address these other greenhouse gases as well?
Yeah, and we talk about carbon a lot. Of course, I use it really as shorthand for greenhouse gases. We're, you know, all of those gases kind of are accounted for and reported publicly as part of our climate reporting every year. And we're working really hard to reduce some of those things. I think, you know, there's a couple things that matter about these other greenhouse gases. I mean, greenhouse gases are a pollutant to the climate, and some of them, such as methane, have orders of magnitude higher negative impacts on warming our climate. But a lot of these also contribute to some of the high particulate matter that's actually a pollutant in the way people think about them, you know, the air we breathe. And so that's why, you know, removing the diesel-sourced fuels for our backup generators for the communities where our data centers operate, that's not just a climate thing. You know, that's a community thing.
Sure. I think that listeners to this podcast understand what going carbon negative means, but you also have another initiative that is focused on water, and your goal is to be water positive by 2030. What does it mean to be water positive?
Yeah, as you can see, I like to be very literal about about these things. So, you know, a lot of people talk about climate positive, and I'm like, I don't know what a positive climate is. I just want a stable climate. But I do know I want things to be carbon negative, and people say, well, that's going to give people a negative connotation. I'm like, yeah, they should have a negative connotation. Water positive. Well, you know, so I want there to be less carbon in the atmosphere when I'm done with my work than there would have been otherwise. I want there to be more water available to people in places where it's in short supply in the places that I operate than there would have been otherwise. And so water positive really means for Microsoft that we will, again, reduce our water use as much as possible in the places where water reduction is an important element of local sustainability. And then we will replenish back into the system through natural methods, wetland restoration, impervious surface removal, all that kind of stuff, as well as technology solutions, direct, you know, water aquifer injection, to ensure that we put more water back than we use. Now, the important thing here is water is super local, right? Carbon goes up, it mixes, atmosphere mixes, and it's a global problem. climate causes water to be a local problem, but in different ways. Some people are getting too much water. Some people are getting too little water. Some people are getting too much water and then too little water, right? And so you have to be really sensitive to that. So what Microsoft is doing is saying, we will replenish more water than we use globally, but we're only going to do those replenishment projects in the areas of high water scarcity. So it's not just that we will replenish more water than we use, but we're kind of doing a load balancing from around the world to ensure that we really concentrate our efforts on water replenishment where water replenishment is most necessary.
What does it mean, you know, specifically to replenish water?
It literally means to put more water back into the aquifer than you took out. it's that simple. Now, how do you do that? Well, look, there are things that we've done to the ecosystem that mean that water leaves when it should stay. We all know when you drive by a parking lot, you drive down city roads in the middle of hard rainstorms and water is just rushing and then it's going into a sewer, or, you know, if we're lucky, it's going into a sewer and then it's all just going. It's going, going, going. And we want that water to stay. And if you walk into a forest, there's this phrase of forest as a sponge, right? You know, the waterfalls in the forest, the detritus on the floor, you know, the leaves slow it down, the detritus on the floor absorbs it, and it eventually all kind of goes back in. We need more of that. So to the extent that we can build those natural systems or remove man-made impervious surfaces, or sometimes you can literally just capture that water, treat that water, and inject it directly back into the aquifer from which it came.
I want to talk about something really exciting that a few hours before we started recording this podcast, Microsoft announced, which I'm really excited about, and it's air travel and innovation in air travel. So what is sustainable aviation fuel, and is it something that you think can be applied to the whole world?
I think that sustainable aviation fuel is a short-term, medium-term, and long-term answer to one of the hardest-to-abate sectors in the climate portfolio that we have. Air travel is a significant contributor to global emissions right now. It's about 2 to 3%. It's projected to grow to up to 22% of global emissions by 2050.
Wow.
So we've got to get out ahead of this. It's a hard one. Electrification, the physics, you know, makes that difficult. We are still far away from hydrogen. So what are we going to do in the next decades? And sustainable aviation fuel makes sense because it's a drop-in fuel. This is a fuel that's created out of organic matters and other sources that actually had withdrawn carbon from the atmosphere already, right? So say that you've got a fuel made out of cooking oils, for instance, that were created using biological feedstock, that those plants took CO2 out, then it was used for cooking. And then you can take that and re-refine it and use it for aviation fuel. And the super important part is that you can just drop that straight into the supply chain. No changes in engines, nothing else. We announced this partnership today with Alaska Air and Sky Energy, where we're purchasing enough sustainable aviation fuel to power our three most popular flights with Alaska Air to San Francisco, San Jose, and LAX. Microsoft's a big company, but in the grand scheme of things, we're dropping the bucket. Alaska's big company, grand scheme of things, dropping the bucket. Our partnership, same thing. But it's indicative of an approach that every company could take, every airline could adopt, and every customer company like Microsoft could take. Can reduce emissions up to 70%. Reduce, again, same as those that diesel and data centers, these local particulate matter issues for air pollution around airports is significant. We can reduce noxious particulate matter by 90% through the use of sustainable aviation fuel. So it's really one of those kind of rare win-wins that seem less rare when you're talking about them in business school.
Yeah, this seems like a great project that will set a model for every other airline. What will it take for the Uniteds and the Deltas of the world to start applying this technology?
Well, I can't speak for the Uniteds and the Deltas, I guess, but I think, you know, sustainable aviation fuel is still too expensive. Microsoft is doing this because we can. not every organization, you know, can afford to pay the premium. I think that green technologies and green solutions often present. So how do you drive down a premium? You need to create a market. And I don't know where we seem to have gotten this idea that like markets just happen. They don't. We create markets, right? Through incentives and early action. And so that's what we're doing. You know, we don't want to pay more for sustainable aviation fuel than other fuels, but we know that if that's what we want, you know, in the long term, then today we have to pay more. If others can follow our lead, it grows the demand, grows the volume. You know, it's all econ 101 here. So that's what we're hoping.
That's great. No, these three initiatives are incredible. And the date that a lot of them are focused on, and yes, we say some 2050, some now that we need to start working on, but 2030 is the year that a lot of people are talking about. And it does line up with the UN Sustainable Development Goals. What is it about this year that is so important that both Microsoft and every world leader say, this is the time where we need to fix things?
Well, I think a decade is just long enough for people to think that we can get some big things done, and just short enough to start to instill the panic that everybody should be feeling. You know, when I talk about 2050, like, 2050 is a long time from now. You know, I think
I'm going to be old by then.
Yeah, you're going to be old. If you're going to be old, I'm definitely going to be old, Adam. I already look that old, but
no.
The IPCC, you know, often talks about 2100, and I'm like, I really want the world to be a good place in 2100, but that's seemingly a long time away. 2030, I think particularly the past couple of years, we've all felt this like acceleration of the clock. I mean, time is just ripping by. And I think everybody now has in a headspace where they realize 2030 is right around the corner. As I said, it's a long enough time, but it's a short enough time. And that's what we're sitting in that sweet spot right now. And so we actually have four kind of all up climate goals, and we're quite literal, or, you know, sustainability goals. We're quite literal about them. So, and they're all 2030, right? So we said by 2030, we're going to be a carbon negative, water positive, zero waste company, and build the infrastructure of a planetary computer, because we also believe that there's a huge need to connect up the large important environmental data sets with, you know, the machine learning and other computational technologies that we need to more appropriately, you know, monitor, model, and ultimately manage our natural systems. I mean, that is the thing. You asked me what's the number one climate issue I want to solve. If you ask me what's my number one frustration right now, it's that people keep saying and believing that we live in an information age when, you know, you could not have come up with a more narcissistic term, because we don't know really anything at all about the rest of the planet that we live on, the rest of life on Earth, the 10 to tens of millions of species we share this planet with and that create the ecosystem that allow us to live the lives that we do. And that is so depressing. It depresses me because I think it shows a lack of intellectual curiosity. I mean, it shows like a lack of fundamental childlike questioning of why and what is this all about. But it also shows just a lack of investment to date in taking what we know are the most powerful technologies, which have transformed our lives, right? And oftentimes for the better, and deploying them in pursuit of solutions to our environmental challenges. So, you know, that when I look at all of that, that's why I chose to join Microsoft as opposed to any other company, right? And why I left academia to do so, because I do believe, technology isn't the silver bullet. It's not, you know, riding in on the white horse to save the day. But I struggle to see a future where we've fully, you know, holistically gotten out ahead of our sustainability challenges, where technology isn't infiltrated across every solution that we've deployed.
So a few times now, you've mentioned artificial intelligence, and I kind of want to dive into this just a little bit deeper, because I think I understand the basics of machine learning, but what really does artificial intelligence have to do with solving these big climate problems?
Well, a lot, actually. It has the potential to help us understand what's going on. It has the potential to help us determine what the most effective actions that we should take are. And it actually has the potential to help us deploy those actions optimally. But look, artificial intelligence at its highest level, everyone's got their different definitions. For me, you know, I do come from a bit kind of maybe overly quantitative background, but literally it's just an algorithm that solves for an objective function, right? That's it. We talk about this stuff, it sounds super fancy, but it's just some sort of algorithm that you say solve for X, and you show it a lot of data about what has happened between X and Y in the past. And it'll figure that out through some complicated statistics. But we can use it in all these kind of incredible ways. Because what is so interesting, and you see the terms that folks in artificial intelligence community use, and they try to map to the way our brains work. And the reason they do that is because it's called artificial intelligence. But, you know, they talk about things like neural networks, et cetera, et cetera. And, but all of that really is kind of this homage to the fact that we are running these algorithms in our head all the time. And people don't really realize that this difference between, you know, data to information to action that our brains are doing. So, you know, when you look outside and you see a tree or an animal and you know what species it is, literally just like light values are hitting, you know, the back of your retina. But then your brain is converting that based on an algorithm and saying, ah, I know what that aggregation of values that you're seeing is. You've been taught to know that that's a deer, that's a squirrel, that's a tree. And we need to teach computers to do that, to be able to see at a scale that humans can't see, to see all of the world's forests at one time, to see all of the world's water at one time. And then there's other types of artificial intelligence that can say, great, well, if we have all this agriculture land, all this forest, et cetera, and we have some objective function that we want to optimize for, like we want to maximize the energy production with the least amount of land. Well, humans have ways of doing that, but we need to do that at a global scale. Human brains don't work that way. So we can ask computers, how would you, what land would you use, and what would you do with it to maximize biodiversity protection, to maximize energy generation, all of those things. And so, you know, all machine learning is math and statistics to do what people do every single day. And that's convert raw data into information and then make some decision, take some action based off of it.
This was by far the best explanation of AI and machine learning that I've ever heard. So thank you so much. I'm sure you helped a lot of people who are listening to understand it, but thank you from me personally. I want to kind of zoom out just a little bit because we've been kind of speaking very focused. Sustainability, as you and I have talked about before, is highly interdisciplinary. And I know you focus on the environmental side of things. But how often do social, political, economic factors worm their way into your work, and in what ways?
All day, in all ways. I think, you know, our first conversation, Adam, you just started hitting me with the social, you know, dimensions of environment. And what's so funny about that is, you know, I'm trained as an ecologist. Even as an environmental scientist and ecologist, you know you can't get away from the fact that like humans and nature are inextricably intertwined. You know, who I am as a person, it naturally wants to try to separate those. My brain is constantly trying to separate those. And reality is constantly telling my brain, and conversations with you as well, are constantly telling my brain, hey, you can't separate those. You know, there is no, like, what's the point of working on sustainability if not in the pursuit of the betterment of the overall human experience, right? But,
sure.
But what's the point of trying to work on social issues if you don't appreciate the fact that everything is predicated upon the health in the environment? Now, I'm an environmental scientist and I'm an okay one, right? I'm not, you know, Darwin. I can't also, you know, learn and be as good as I am in environmental science and social science and all the different aspects of it. And because of that, sustainability is one of, if not the most interdisciplinary space I've ever seen. Nobody can know enough about all of the things that need to happen. But, you know, interdisciplinarity, you know, the only effective form of interdisciplinarity is one that people bring an extremely open and extremely accepting mindset to that, hey, you know what? I mean, I always bring the mindset that even on my topics, I'm probably the dumbest in the room, but you have to appreciate that on all of these other topics, you definitely are the dumbest person in the room, and you have to listen to all of these other concerns and then figure out a way to bring your perspective, your specialty into that grand kind of mosaic. And it requires, I think, an unusual level of humility and humbleness in any type of collaboration that I've seen. And, you know, I wouldn't say that humans are the best at humility and humbleness. So I think that that's actually one of the biggest struggles, quite frankly, in sustainability is its interdisciplinary nature. And I'm not convinced humans, you know, are that great at that, but it's the thing that we have to evolve the most rapidly towards.
Yeah. I mean, my degrees are in law, and I'm very focused on sustainability from that perspective. And it's funny, I like to think of myself and a lot of the people that we have on this podcast as systems thinkers. They think about systems, but nobody is able to really conceptualize the system in its entirety. So as much as you like to say that you can zoom out and look at things from a global perspective, you really need to just focus on your area and become such an expert in that that you can contribute to the system in a way that helps it to function properly.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And actually, that is why I'm so interested in technology, because the human brain is not evolved to think at that scale. And technology is not evolved to think at the level of nuance and societal sophistication that the human brain is. Yeah. And so we need to bring that. No, I'm fine. Thank you. Sorry. Here, come here for a second. We need to interrupt. My daughter is wanting to ask me if she's not going to believe that I'm actually talking to you, Adam.
Hello.
This is Elle, and she made me promise to say hey to Adam and AJR. So, sorry. No, I don't want anything.
Hello.
Okay, love you. All right, fine. Sorry about that. The perils of home interviews. Sorry.
You were saying how much you agreed with what I just said.
That's right. So I think what you said was brilliant. No, but one of the things that I love about your background, besides the fact that my daughter, you know, loves your music, is is that you bring that level of appreciation for the whole system, but from a few particular areas that you're passionate about and want to be highly educated in. And so many people come to me and they say, how can I be the chief environmental officer of a Microsoft, etc.? And I think, you know, it's not that I don't want people to be the next chief environmental officer of whatever company. We need lots of them, but we don't need that many of them. Much more what we need is everybody to take what they're particularly passionate about, whether it's music, law, human rights, or biodiversity conservation and the beauty of evolution and the maintenance of that process, and say, okay, that's what fires me up. That's what I care about. That's the hill I'm willing to die on here, right? Now let's bring that skill, that passion to the broader conversation. And it's like if you were on a massive construction site and every single worker wanted to understand how they could be the general contractor, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oftentimes if you go and talk to the general contractor, all they want to do is get back to doing the work.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, it makes so much sense. I have one last question for you before we run out of time, and I want to kind of focus back on you specifically. You do all of this work that has an effect on the world at such a large scale. Do you think that this is something that you reflect in your personal life, in your day-to-day life, in your small actions that you take?
Oh man, I talk to myself about this every day, and I hope so. But, you know, personally, I hope so. But professionally, I know that whatever I'm doing isn't enough.
Yeah.
I think that, I think that that's the hard thing that you have to square and kind of be okay with is that, you know, I say a lot, if you go into sustainability and you're looking for self-validation, you know, you're looking for validation, you're looking for, you know, like good luck, that's not coming your way. And I, you know, I'm my own harshest critic and I look at the choices I make, talk to my kids about the choices that they want to make. And you quickly realize that you're so far from the ideal. But you also realize that the ideal is in a lot of modern societies impossible today because of the systems and the constraints that we have. So, you know, you ask that question that I ask myself every day, and the answer can be nothing other than no. Am I happy, you know, with the with my progress? Absolutely not. I'm not happy with anyone else's either, but I think you got to start looking at yourself first.
Maybe we should have ended the episode with the last question, which was much more inspiring, you know, kind of a rah-rah ending.
Well, look, I don't think this is, I don't think it's depressing at all. I think, you know, the ending by looking at yourself is, and starting with looking at yourself, those, you know, everyone wants to know, it's like, oh, is individual action enough? Of course not. Like only if every individual that works in this space, is it enough? But if it's nobody's job, if it's everybody's job, nobody gets, you know, so anyway, I don't know. It's a complicated issue that really makes you get to the heart of what are we working towards? I've heard a lot of commentary that's moved me over the past year about social justice, and then particularly in the pandemic, just a broadening of that to all peoples, right? As this pandemic has kind of washed its kind of negative impacts over everybody and the economy and people's health and livelihoods. And there's this question about, you know, what do I want for myself? And then if I want that for myself, why would I not want that for all of my fellow humans? And I don't think there's a person on earth that there isn't some sort of contradiction between those two things. And so we all have to ask ourselves that question. And that's the broader question that I ask myself about, like, what do I want for the world versus what do I do every day? And why is there a delta between that? And then I look at that delta and I think about, like, okay, that's where you have opportunity to take action with your career, with your personal choices, with the way you raise your family or interact with your friends and others.
I so appreciate you taking the time and making us think about these larger questions and making us think about these very specific areas where we all can do better, whether we're individuals or businesses or even government. So thank you so much, Lucas, for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. I love these conversations. And, you know, I'm going to spend a lot of time after this conversation thinking about what we talked about. So I appreciate it.
Amazing. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Also, follow us on Instagram at sustainable.partners. Today's episode was engineered by Drew Alsbrook, produced and edited by Shelby Kaufman, and executive produced by Sustainable Partners, Inc. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.